Creel Marcus is one of America's most respected cultural critics. In his new book, The Shape of Things to Come, Prophecy in the American Voice, Marcus traces America's story of self-invention and nationhood, from its early Puritan beginnings to the way it's retold by contemporary artists.
America is different not because it's better, not because it's truer, not because it really is blessed by God, but because it was made up. America is a few pieces of paper. It's a few speeches, then the Declaration of Independence, then the Constitution, and then a few more speeches explaining what those documents were all about, like the Gettysburg Address. That's America.
Creel Marcus told Steve Paulson about the origin of his new book.
The book came into focus about 10 years ago when I gave a talk called Four Moments of Prophecy. And these were four moments when somebody stood up and spoke in public and said, we are special, we have been especially blessed, and because of that, if we betray ourselves, we'll be punished beyond all knowing, all experience. And that's John Winthrop in 1630 on the way to the founding of New England. It's Abraham Lincoln in his second inaugural when he looks at the Civil War that's almost over. He looks into the face of slavery and he says, if this war has to go on for as long as it takes for every drop of blood that was drawn by the lash in slavery to be repaid by blood drawn by the sword, so be it. He's saying that a crime has been committed that is so great that it might never be paid, and that the nation might labor under that debt, that unpayable debt forever. Martin Luther King takes up exactly the same theme in his address to the March on Washington in 1963. And just 3 years later, in the middle of the Vietnam War, Allen Ginsberg is riding around Kansas in a Volkswagen bus, and he, unlike Lincoln or Winthrop or King, explicitly calls himself a prophet. I've come to Kansas to make prophecy, to somehow glimpse the shape of the judgment the country is unknowingly enacting on itself by the crime of this war. And it's an absolutely extraordinary poem. It's 45 minutes long when it's recited. And it just goes all over the state, and it never forgets that it is in a vortex. It is dead center of the USA, Kansas. When you look at it on a map, it's like the drain in a shower stall. You can imagine the whole country swirling around it and the water going down that drain. Mm.
Now, one of the arguments that you make in your book, The Shape of Things to Come, that is really quite provocative is that the story of self-invention, of nationhood, is perhaps told more often nowadays in art than in politics.
Well, I think you reach a point with Lincoln's second inaugural when he, in essence, threatens the nation with an eternity of punishment, where this concept becomes so dangerous and so threatening that public figures, politicians, presidents, senators run from it. They begin to speak a different language. And so the burden of pursuing this notion of a country that is made up, that is specially blessed, that may be especially punished, that falls to artists. And because it's something that is in all of us, it is in any American artist. Now, some will express it, some won't. Some will cultivate it as a story, some won't. I think Philip Roth does this very, very self-consciously. He's completely aware of the kind of questions we've been talking about.
You're David talking Lynch, about the Philip Roth in his trio of novels, American Pastoral, I Married a Communist, and The Human Stain.
Those three and The Plot Against America, too, I think. But he has thought all this through, and this has become his subject. I mean, I'm not imposing, I don't think, my ideas on those novels by Philip Roth to a good degree. My ideas grew out of those novels, my reading of those novels. David Lynch may approach these same questions differently than Roth does, but with no less fervor, maybe with more instinct, less thought. I'm not sure. Mm.
David Lynch, but the filmmaker, the guy who did Twin Peaks and Blue Velvet, I guess I've never heard him discussed in the same breath as Philip Roth.
Well, I think they have a tremendous amount in common. I think they're both trying to say, what is this place? Why is it so dangerous? Why do horrible, unpredictable things happen at any moment? I think their terrain, the way they see the city they live in, is very, very similar.
Hmm. Well, let me follow up on each of those for a moment. Philip Roth, first of all, is there a particular scene in one of his novels that really jumps out at you where he's really getting at this notion of American prophecy?
Yeah, there is one scene for me. Other people will, you know, might pick something else. This comes in American Pastoral, and it's when the hero of the book, the Swede, a man who, as he thinks of it, his family has rooted itself in America in every way. He's from a Jewish family in Newark. He's a successful businessman. Everyone admires him. Everyone looks up to him. He's a great athlete. He is called the Swede because even though he's Jewish, he looks just like Robert Redford. He is, as the narrator of the book, remembering him from high school, says, he was our Kennedy. So he is the blessed man. And his daughter, in the midst of the Vietnam War as a teenager, gets involved with radicals. She blows up the local post office because that's the outpost of the federal government in their little village in rural New Jersey, accidentally kills a beloved local doctor, goes underground. 5 years later, after the most horrible self-torture, the Swede, the man who is the paragon of absolute virtue, who has never in his life done anything but the right thing, he's told he can meet his daughter. He finds his daughter in a horrible, ruined street in Newark, and she has become like a cult member. She is a sort of zombie, but she's also tough as nails, and she takes him to her hideous room, and then she throws him out. And the Swede goes back home, and he's tortured. He doesn't know what to do, and he calls his brother. And his brother is not like the Swede. His brother is a total reprobate. He obeys no morals. He has no code. He just shoots his mouth off. He's an emotionally violent man. And he says to his brother, you know, go back there and get her. Drag her out of that place by her hair. And he says, I can't do that kind of thing. I could never do anything like that. And his brother says, you're afraid of letting the beast out of the bag. And his brother says the Swede, the paragon, the hero, says these horribly pathetic words. He says, what beast? Hmm. And what beast is the subject of that book? And what beast, revealing the beast, pointing at the beast, is what a prophet does when the prophet stands out in public and speaks to the people. But in this little scene on a telephone between two brothers, this scene is being enacted, and it goes on and on and on. And, you know, I shook when I first read it, and I shake when I read it again.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have also a fascinating critical take on another David Lynch project, his 1997 film Lost Highway, and specifically the actor Bill Pullman, and Bill Pullman's face. Why do you find his face to be so significant?
Bill Pullman has this very bland, ordinary-looking, very handsome face. And there's something so ordinary and handsome about him that when you talk about him, people are always confusing him, and I do it too, with other actors, Bill Paxton, maybe Jeff Daniels. They say, wasn't he in Something Wild? Oh, no, right, that was Jeff Daniels. Was he in Titanic? Oh, no, that was Bill Paxton. And yet, there's a whole series of roles that he's played over the years where he plays characters who, from movie to movie, seem to deepen in their nihilism. A whole set of gestures and expressions seem to take on more weight. And you're seeing the portrayal of someone who is believing in less and less as the years go by. And so he becomes a kind of walking figure of nihilism, walking through the years, walking across different aspects of the American landscape, becoming someone more self-loathing, self-hating, self-disgusting every time. And yet there is always a flicker of doubt in his eyes, maybe around his mouth, that this isn't the whole story. There is like a memory of something more. And I think what you see here and the argument I make, the picture I try to draw to carry other people along, is a picture of this figure really embodying a version of the country, one possibility for the country, that as the years go by, it becomes more and more emptied, that its betrayal of its own promises becomes harder and harder, to the point that there will be no way out, that there will be no escape. That's not what I believe to be the whole story, but I see in Bill Pullman's work over 20 years or so an argument about one possibility. He is enacting one version of the American story.
So it's
that's
like
what I see in his face. And, you know, people take this to be, what an odd approach to things. Well, you know, I just go to the movies.
Greil Marcus is the author of The Shape of Things to Come, Prophecy and the American Voice. He spoke with Steve Paulson.